I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Should anthropologists be embedded with troops in war zones? The debate continues, even as at least two of them have been killed. We'll have that story. But first, today was the bloodiest day in Iraq in over a month. Three female suicide bombers blew themselves up during a Shiite pilgrimage to a Baghdad holy site, killing more than 30, wounding scores. And another female militant detonated herself in the northern city of Kirkuk, killing at least 25. Ned Parker of the Los Angeles Times is in Baghdad. Ned, you write today that the question there is what happens as the U.S. military pulls out the rest of the surge troops this month. Is today's violence the answer to that question?
I wouldn't say that it is the answer to that question. What happened today reveals a great deal about the sectarian and ethnic tensions in Iraq. In Baghdad, the three female suicide bombers targeting Shiite pilgrims on a religious holiday is a sign of the tensions between Sunnis and Shias, and the fact that there is a definite contingent still within Iraq's Sunni minority, the former elite under Saddam Hussein, who believe in the use of force and in this militaristic force to destabilize the country.
Well, and let's just touch on the fact that these were all female suicide bombers. We know it's increasingly common because it's easier for them to conceal, you know, explosives under their long traditional clothing. But we also understood that at least at the pilgrimage, security forces had deployed, 200 women reportedly to search female pilgrims. So, what are security officials saying about how hard that's become to spot the female suicide bombers?
It's extremely difficult. It's difficult enough to search the males. I was out today on the back of a scooter checking out the streets of Baghdad out of curiosity, and they did quite a lot. A lot of lanes are shut down, so you simply have Shiite pilgrims, meaning men, women, children, walking down the street. And every so often, there's sort of a checkpoint, and some of them there are men who are searching the pilgrims as they walk by, and others there are some women. Someone's going to get through. You have a million people coming to town, and that's really the challenge for security right now in Iraq and in Baghdad.
But as you write, today's bombings come at a time of relative calm, and, accent on the relative, nearly 500 Iraqis died this month, but that's compared to 3,700 during the worst month of 2006. And you write about people sitting in cafes, enjoying nightlife, but you also say it's in part because the country's become so balkanized. Tell us more about that.
You can go across Baghdad now and find scenes of ordinary life, things that we take for granted that in Iraq right now seem slightly extraordinary, but it's happening within specific districts. You can go to an area in western Baghdad that's sealed off with walls, and there the shops will be open till 10, 11 at night. People will sit at cafes, but it's because their neighborhood right now is, to an extent, purged of people from the other sect, whether that's Sunni or Shiite.
You mentioned that there will be suicide bombings as long as people have the political will to do that. How might that be changed? So far, elections in Iraq remain unscheduled. Is there any possibility that these different ethnic groups can come up with an adequate power-sharing formula to reduce some of that, the tension and the political will?
The challenges with that are, finding ways to integrate the people we call Sons of Iraq now, former Sunni insurgents who decided to make an alliance with the Americans against al-Qaeda in Iraq because they found the extremism of al-Qaeda as too nihilistic, too painful, dictatorial. They felt, hey, we strike a deal with the Americans. The challenge is now, here you have these former Sunni insurgents who want to buy in, and the question is, will they be able to? And it's a similar question with the Shia of the cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, who has his Medi-Army militia that is considered an anarchic, chaotic, dangerous force. But it also represents the voice of the dispossessed in Iraq for the Shia, bringing those people into the system, giving those types of people a voice, will go a long way towards stabilizing Iraq.
Ned Parker covers Iraq for the Los Angeles Times. He's been speaking to us from Baghdad. Ned, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, would American anthropologists help calm the sectarian strife in Iraq? Back in May, the first social scientist sent to work alongside the U.S. military in Afghanistan was killed by a roadside bomb when the convoy he was riding in came under attack. 31-year-old Michael Bhatia, an expert on Afghan culture, had been in Afghanistan with the military for only a few months as part of a new program called the Human Terrain System. Social scientists working alongside U.S. troops in 5-member teams advising them on the subtleties of local culture. Well, that's renewed an old debate about academics in war. Critics say the program removes a precious firewall, that subjects can't trust anthropologists if they think they might be carrying weapons or feeding the military information that might be used to further warfare instead of science. The military is planning to send more human terrain teams into war zones, so how's it going? Well, it depends on who you ask. We turn first to Tom Garcia, an Air Force veteran who's now a private consultant with the defense contractor BAE Systems, training human terrain teams at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas. He was in Michael Bhatia's convoy when it came under attack, so Tom, let's start there. You are military. Michael was civilian and a researcher. What was your relationship like?
My relationship with Michael was just absolutely one of the most wonderful gifts that I've ever had in my life. I knew him for 6 months. We worked together, and we're pretty much together 24/7 at a fire base in Afghanistan. We spent a lot of time in both coach, teach, mentor of each other, learning about each other, and certainly trying to accomplish our mission to the best of our ability. I'm an only child, and I truly feel like that I lost a brother the day that he was killed.
Oh, well, I'm terribly sorry for your loss. But the other thing that you're saying is that, at least in the way that it was intended, it seemed to work, and that Michael wasn't in your way. Michael helped you with your work. How did he?
Michael was an integral part of what we were doing. His experiences in Afghanistan prior to being part of the human terrain team helped out tremendously. And we were in a particular village. It was a known bad area, hostile area, and we were out in a marketplace doing some interviews. And Michael's, I guess his demeanor, just people gravitated towards him because they felt that he truly listened, that he could make a difference. And, brought up multiple issues, the tribal disconnects, the security situations in the area, and brought all that forward in a manner that just really hadn't been presented to the military personnel that were already in the area, putting some historical touches on, the 80-year land dispute that was going on, that was perceived to be, tribal dispute simply because one tribe didn't like another, and people not realizing that that wasn't the case at all, that it wasn't just a tribal dispute. It was about a dispute over resources that had been, taken away, which in Afghanistan are very, very important, extremely important.
So he gave you that insight into what the people were thinking. So overall, how would you assess, the human terrain team goes on, you're training others. How would you assess how they're working?
From my experience in Afghanistan, I think they're working great. It's the Army. I think it's a big step for the Army to come forward and embrace an organization like ours and want to interact with us and to truly listen and see that they are in a situation that they've never been in before, speaking this particular type of warfare, and that there is room for non-kinetic type actions.
Well, in fact, some critics of both the war in Afghanistan and Iraq are saying that the Pentagon should have known much more about the cultures of each country before invading, and that people like anthropologists should have been drawn in earlier on to help with that. But you well know the criticism. The anthropologist David Price has written about how anthropologists during World War II used their credentials as a front for spying, and huge controversy over that because other anthropologists felt that that endangered them if people in the field thought that they were spies. And then in Vietnam, anthropologists found that work that they provided the government was then used to identify tribal leaders that the CIA reportedly then assassinated. So anthropologists felt that instead of providing direction for the military, they provided them a roadmap to kill people, which is against you know, the moral code of anthropologists. They can't conduct research that will cause harm to subjects. So do you worry that the original mission, that might be somehow corrupted, and that anthropologists, people like your late friend, might be used, you know, in a different way? Do you worry about that?
From my own experiences on the human train team for Afghanistan, AF1, I do not worry about that. You know, I know the type of information that we provided them and how we assisted them, and that it wasn't, any sort of intelligence gathering. It wasn't any sort of targeting. It wasn't anything on the kinetic side or the use of force. It was everything on the non-kinetic side, and I don't believe that the information that we did provide them could be used in a kinetic manner at all.
And one last question. What about your own safety? Do you worry, as someone has said, that when anthropologists are for hire in this manner, you might get anthropology for hire? Some critics have said that you might start getting anthropologists who really aren't as well trained as others, scrambling for these jobs. We understand some of them are paid over $100,000 a year. And that you may not be getting the top information. You yourself are hired by a contractor, so there's, you know, where's the filter? Where's the vetting process for your safety? Do you worry about that?
My safety. I mean, it's a combat zone, so I think anyone who voluntarily, you know, puts themselves in that situation, it's like everyone in our team. I mean, everyone volunteered to be there. You know, I think there are people that, many people in the world that wish they could do something to change the world in a positive way. I think there are a few of those that end up regretting having not taken an opportunity to change the world in a positive way. And there are very few that get off the fence and go do it. I think the vetting process of information, I don't think people will just run out and jump in the middle of combat for $100,000. Frankly, it's not worth it. There's not. my life is a lot, worth a hell of a lot more than that.
And you don't worry about depending on anthropologists who may not be of the caliber of a Michael Badia?
I think honestly, it would be hard for someone to be on that same level. He was a very very amazing man, and I think one thing about this program is that, I guess the strength of this program is that everyone has something different to bring to the table. I once spoke to an individual about preparing for change or preparing for disaster, and one of my colleagues was trying to understand, how does someone in Afghanistan prepare for a bad winter or prepare for some disaster, and the answer just wasn't coming, and eventually the gentleman said, how do you prepare for disaster when you're already in it? Is it human terrain that's the answer? I'm not sure. It's part of the answer, I do believe. I think it's a little bit of everything, but mostly I think it's about giving people the support that they need to feel secure and to provide the means for them to get through to tomorrow, to the next week, to the next month on a long-term basis.
Tom Garcia, 17-year Air Force veteran who's now training human terrain teams, including anthropologists at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas. Tom, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Yes, ma'am. My pleasure.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, an anthropologist who is against this program. Also, later today, if the government shifted priorities in Medicare payments, would we have more primary care physicians? Back in a minute, here and now. We're taking a look at human terrain teams, which the U.S. military is operating in Iraq and Afghanistan. On each team, two social scientists work alongside three members of the military. The scientists conduct interviews and gather information to help the military understand the local culture. On May 7th, Michael Bhatia became the first social scientist in a human terrain team to be killed. 2 weeks before, he was killed by an AIED in Afghanistan. Bhatia's former brigade commander told Congress that the human terrain team, of which he was a member, helped the brigade reduce civilian deaths and increased local support for the Afghan government. Well, we turn now to Roberto Gonzalez, who's an associate professor of anthropology at San Jose State University in California. He's a founding member of the Network of Concerned Anthropologists, an ad hoc group created to promote what they call ethical anthropology. He's also the author of a forthcoming book on human terrain systems. Roberto, Professor, you heard our interview with Tom Garcia, an impassioned defender who trains these teams, knew Michael Bhatia, who argued these teams saved lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just first of all comment on Michael Bhatia. His tragic death is something that I think any social scientist who found out about was just devastated by. He, unfortunately, has not been the first human terrain team casualty. In fact, there was another social scientist by the name of Nicole Suvejes. She was killed just about a month ago, and she was killed in Sadr City, Baghdad. The fact is that the vast majority of these human terrain teams are actually operating in Iraq. I believe there are a total of 26, and 25 out of those 26 are based in Iraq.
And what are you saying? Should they be there, in your point of view? Is the fact that they're getting killed the problem of the program, or is it the price to pay for, as some would say, they're helping to save lives?
I think that that the loss of life of social scientists is but one part of a much bigger problem from my understanding of history, my reading of history. My concern, I've really got two sets of concerns about the human terrain programs. The first are broad concerns that I have as a taxpayer. I have spoken with several former employees of the human terrain system, some of whom have contacted me out of concern, out of concerns that they have from having participated in the program. And it's been described to me in some cases as a boondoggle that is benefiting very few others other than BAE Systems, which is the UK-based contractor that's been awarded the human terrain contract. And what they described to me is severe, gross mismanagement of the program on a number of different levels. You alluded to one earlier in terms of the lack of qualifications of many of the social scientists. Now, I think Michael Bhatia is clearly an exception to that based on what I know about his research and his cultural familiarity with Afghanistan. But the first group, the first cohort of human terrain teams were deployed last year. And of the anthropologists that were sent to Afghanistan and Iraq, you had one who was an expert on Philippine hunting-gathering groups, another expert on Latin American archaeology. Neither of these men had any experience prior to their service on these teams in Afghanistan or Iraq or the Middle East.
But do they, as you know, just because in the field, just because they are anthropologists or social scientists, don't they have a better way of reading people than perhaps, you know, a troop member who's been trained to look for explosive devices and maybe doesn't have a sense of how to read a different culture? Don't these people have a better way of doing that that can be helpful?
I'm really not convinced that they do, to be honest. And I say this out of my 2 years of experience in an indigenous Indian village in southern Mexico. After 2 years, I only started to scratch the surface of the kinship networks and of the economic system and the political system there.
Well, as you said, you have a forthcoming book on human terrain systems. Remind us, where did the phrase come from?
It's very interesting. I remember clearly when I first heard the term, I was sort of stunned because it seemed to be equating human beings with territory or ground or earth. And so I was intrigued by the term and began doing some research on it and found that, lo and behold, the term first appears in the late 1960s in the context of the House Un-American Activities Committee, which was investigating what they called, quote-unquote, guerrilla advocates or subversive groups in the United States.
So it has a pejorative, you know, potentially for a lot of people, and now it's being used in other countries. But the Pentagon has insisted that this is not about helping the U.S. military attack the people in Afghanistan and Iraq, but rather helping them understand them so that it leads to less deaths of people in Iraq and Afghanistan.
I would like to read just a very small excerpt from a lieutenant colonel with experience in Iraq. His name is John Gentile, and this is what he had to say about the human terrain teams. These human terrain teams, whether they want to acknowledge it or not, in a generalized and subtle way, do at some point contribute to the collective knowledge of a commander, which allows him to target and kill the enemy in the civil war in Iraq. Stop sugarcoating what these teams do and end up being a part of. To deny that fact is to deny the reality of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. This was posted in late October last year, and it really sort of struck me because here's somebody with experience as an armored reconnaissance squadron commander in West Baghdad telling the readers of this small wars journal blog, that essentially, like it or not, the human terrain data can be used for that purpose. And I should tell you that these teams are part of the military chain of command. They report to the brigade commander. And so whether or not they're wittingly or unwittingly providing information as intelligence for potentially targeting suspects, that's clearly what the message is that the lieutenant colonel has for us. And so it's not that anthropologists don't have contributions to make. The problem is that the Pentagon is asking the anthropologists and other social scientists now to sort of come in after the fact.
You're saying anthropologists, social scientists can play a role of educating and informing prior to a war, but you don't want to see them participating in executing the war in any way?
That's right. That's right. Because I think at that point you cease to become an anthropologist and you become something else.
Roberto Gonzalez, Associate Professor of Anthropology at San Jose State University in California, also a founding member of the Network of Concerned Anthropologists. He's also the author of a forthcoming book on human terrain systems. Professor Gonzalez, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, and this note, tomorrow on Here and Now, a change of pace. As we look back at 1968, we'll listen to one of the most famous performances ever recorded, Johnny Cash at Folsom Prison. That's tomorrow. Back after the news, Here and Now. This month, Congress passed a Medicare bill that puts the brakes on a scheduled 10% cut in payments to doctors. Instead, doctors will see a 1% payment increase. President Bush vetoed the legislation, calling it fiscally irresponsible, but Congress overrode that veto. Well, a new study by doctors at Harvard Medical School took a closer look at how government insurers like Medicare pay doctors, especially specialists, for their services, and asked if possibly this pay schedule is contributing to an income gap among doctors and a shortage of primary care physicians. The study is published in the Journal of General Internal Medicine on the writing team, Proponents of National Health Care. Dr. Karen Lasser was the lead author. She joins us in the studio. And Dr. Lasser, walk us through. When embarking on the study, what did you start with?
We went into the study knowing that nationwide there is a shortage of primary care doctors. We also knew that there's a big income discrepancy between primary care doctors and specialists. For example, the most poorly paid type of primary care doctor is a geriatrician who makes about $165,000 a year. And the most highly paid specialist is a hematologist-oncologist who makes more than $500,000 a year. And so we were wondering, what proportion of these different specialist incomes comes from the public payers, such as Medicare and Medicaid?
Meaning the government.
Government. So how much of this income discrepancy could be accounted for by the government versus how much of it is determined by free market forces? Because the flip side of that is how much of this income discrepancy could be remediable through measures of health policy.
And what did you conclude?
We concluded that a substantial amount of the income from the various specialists comes from the public payers. For example, among four medical specialties, which are the geriatricians, the hematologist-oncologists, the nephrologists, and the rheumatologists, these specialists derive more than half of their revenues from government sources, yet their incomes vary more than threefold.
And taking that further, you know that there's a threefold difference in the salaries. What did you conclude? I mean, is the government really responsible?
Well, I don't know that I'd say the government is responsible, but the government might be part of the solution, because we know that medical students come out of medical school burdened with debt. And so when they're given the choice of going into primary care as a career or going into radiology, for example, they may choose the specialty career because they'll be able to pay back their loans. However, I think this hurts patients because the result is that there's a primary care shortage. They have trouble finding a primary care doctor. And we do know that primary care saves lives and reduces health care disparities.
Well, there's a huge primary care shortage already, and there's one of 44,000 primary care physicians projected by 2025. Give us some more examples of discrepancies, not just in doctors' incomes, but in the percentage of their incomes that comes from government programs.
A cardiologist makes as much from Medicare alone as an entire geriatrician's salary, and they require the same amount of training.
Now, what is it about Medicare payouts that makes the discrepancy?
Well, I think a lot more value is placed on performing procedures than on thinking and talking to patients and in coordinating their care.
So the increasingly rare geriatricians mm-hmm. who spend hours perhaps talking with their patients mm-hmm. are not reimbursed for that as much as, let's say, a brain surgeon is for 2 hours in surgery.
Absolutely.
And yet both might be life-saving.
Yeah, I mean, I can give you an example. I was just thinking of a patient I saw this week in my primary care clinic. It was an elderly Haitian woman who came in to see me. She had diabetes, hypertension, high cholesterol, and depression. I had 20 minutes to cover all of this ground with her. It was the first time I'd ever seen her. It turned out she had an abnormal stress test last summer, never saw a cardiologist, came in to see me also on top of these chronic conditions. She was having chest pain. So I said, I've got to pick up the phone and make an appointment for this patient right now to see the cardiologist. I had the interpreter in the room. Then I call the cardiologist and they say, we only see patients in the afternoon. She said, I can't get a ride there. So I had to arrange cab vouchers to take her to and from that appointment. So clearly I went beyond my 20-minute limit. But that's an example of what a primary care visit has turned into today, where some of the specialists do a procedure and get paid at a much higher rate.
Well, but then someone would say that those specialists need higher payments to cover higher malpractice insurance costs or the need to purchase more expensive medical equipment. You took time, or a geriatrician takes time, but a brain surgeon has to, you know, buy millions of dollars of equipment.
But in our study, we actually looked at net income, and this accounts for all of those other costs.
The American Geriatric Society estimates, we know that there are 7,600 certified geriatricians in the country. 20,000 are needed. How can this be changed? Do you have suggestions as well as your conclusion?
Well, I have a comment first and then a conclusion. I think it's really interesting that, or actually ironic, that Medicare was created to take care of the elderly. Yet most of these Medicare dollars are going to pay specialists. The geriatricians are underpaid. Older Americans are underserved. So I think the way to remedy this problem is to create some parity. I'm thinking of the recent example of the United Kingdom, where they had a big income discrepancy between the specialists and the primary care doctors. And so what they did is they raised the salaries of the primary care doctors, and the primary care shortage vanished. The idea is some of the Medicare dollars should go to supporting the salaries of geriatricians at a rate that would encourage people to go into geriatrics.
And that you have to take from somewhere else.
Well, I think you will need to take from somewhere else, but it may be that certain specialists won't be able to make over $300,000 anymore.
I notice on the list is plastic surgery. It's way up on the list.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to believe. I mean, I'm sure there is a lot of medical plastic surgery,
mm-hmm.
but I'm guessing most of it is cosmetic.
A lot of it's cosmetic.
Why are Medicare dollars going to cosmetic plastic surgery?
It's a great question. Actually, one thing I wanted to mention is when you ask, well, who decides how are these Medicare reimbursement rates created? The AMA has a committee called the RUC, and this committee makes annual recommendations regarding reimbursement to the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Who sits on this committee? It's mainly specialists. There's a vast underrepresentation of the primary care specialties. So it's the AMA's committee that's making recommendations to the Center for Medicare and Medicaid, and that's how this is all happening.
This is Harvard University's Dr. Karen Lasser. For more on her study, go to our website, here-now.org. Dr. Lasser, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, you're welcome. It was a pleasure.
By the way, what are your thoughts about Medicare, doctors' incomes, anything else you've heard on the program? Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can always give us a call and leave a message, 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. We love to hear from you. Quick note, tomorrow, Gene Robinson, New Hampshire's openly gay Anglican bishop, he's at the center of the controversy at the big church confab in Canterbury, England, even though he wasn't invited to the event. We'll speak with him tomorrow. You're listening to Here and Now. Children's author Louisa May Alcott of Little Women fame once said, "Good books, like good friends, are few and chosen. The more select, the more enjoyable." Well, today we have a good friend in the studio to bring us some enjoyable select books, our annual Children's Summer Reading List. Sherry Eskin, children's librarian at the Honan Alston branch of the Boston Public Library. Sherry, welcome back.
Thank you.
And before we dive into some of these great books, and they're arrayed all around the table here, what would you say are some trends you're seeing in children's books this year?
There's a lot about self-discovery, and you see that a lot in kids' books, especially for the grades 3 to 5 that we've chosen. You're finding out who you are amongst your friends and amongst your family and amongst your schoolmates and finding out it's okay to be yourself.
Well, let's start with elementary school. You describe these books as happier in your own skin books, the, you know, self-discovery books. Let's start with The Doll People by Ann Martin and Laura Godwin. It's about dolls that come to life. Now, we've recruited some young friends to do readings for us today. First up, 11-year-old Chihiro Ichikawa.
"You should take the oath now," the other doll said. "The Doll Code of Honor. If you make a mistake and put the secret life of dolls in danger, you could become an ordinary doll again." An ordinary doll. Even though she had taken the oath over 100 years earlier, whenever Annabelle remembered this particular moment of her birthday, she shuddered slightly. It made her think about permanent doll state.
Permanent doll state. Sounds ominous. And I'm looking at the book. The pictures are sort of pencil sketches.
Also in the beginning, you see Brian Selznick, the illustrator, the very first couple pages, he's done a very cool catalog of old-fashioned dolls, because the main characters in this book are 100-year-old porcelain dolls.
And so what is it? Is it scary?
Oh, no, but permanent doll state is not something you want to happen to you. If a human sees you moving around, because, of course, dolls move around and have their own lives and do tons of things while we're not looking.
Right.
And if humans see you, then you're threatened with permanent doll state. And just so you know, Barbies never come out of permanent doll state.
Well, the concept is that these dolls, these porcelain dolls, are looking for an aunt who's been missing for 45 years. So, I mean, it's truly delightful. What age would you say?
Oh, I'd say grades 3 to 5, even second grade if you read it together.
Let's take a look at another elementary school book. It's called Emmy and the Incredible Shrinking Rat by Lynn Jonell. Tell us about this book.
Emmy is one of those girls that just seems to be invisible to everybody. No one seems to notice that she's there. Mm. And she also has a really evil nanny, which is a classic trope in children's literature, right, to have the evil nanny. And her parents, who used to be booksellers who did love her and care about her, they go away all the time and they jet set and they don't seem to care. And she's having a really hard time with this and she can't figure it out. And then she gets bitten by the classroom rat. And she enters into this whole world of talking animals who tell her all these things, and all these animals help her figure out what's going on with her life.
Huh.
One of the nicest things about this book is that the illustrator, Jonathan Bean, has done a flip book on the outside of the pages. So if you flip through the whole book, you can see the rat fall from a branch and then land in Emmy's hands.
Oh, look at that.
It's beautiful.
Oh, there he goes, down the side as I flip through the whole book. Okay, so there's that, Emmy and the Incredible Shrinking Rat. And by the way, we'll, of course, have all the books at our website, here-now.org. Let's take a look at the final elementary school book, Golden and Gray, An Unremarkable Boy and a Rather Remarkable Ghost.
Well, Tom Golden is, again, one of these kids who's sort of a loner, kind of an outcast. Kids pick on him a little bit. And Gray Arthur, the ghost in this story, can't decide what kind of ghost he wants to be when he grows up. And you have a lot of options if you're a ghost. You can be a poltergeist. You can be a screamer. You can be a faintly real. And he hasn't quite figured it out. And then he sees Tom at the same moment. They both say, "Life isn't fair." And they bond together, and Gray Arthur decides that he is going to become Tom's invisible friend.
And a thread of the storyline is that someone decides to use the ghost to win the lottery because ghosts see the future.
Yeah, ghosts can find out things that we cannot find out, and Tom gets kidnapped so that his ghost friend will help a con man win the lottery, and all the other ghosts help them escape. One of the great things about the book is all the funny ghosts in it. So we learn about, like, the poltergeists who steal our socks and steal the pen that you used to have on your desk and steal that one important piece of paper. So that's one of the funniest things about that book are the ghosts in it.
Sherry Eskin, children's librarian at the Honan Alston branch of the Boston Public Library, with our reading list for kids. Next up, middle and high school students, should they be reading about teen suicide? Well, they are. Back in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
How old are you?
17.
How long have you been 17?
A while.
That's the movie trailer for Twilight, coming out this fall. The movie was adapted from the best-selling book series of the same name by Stephanie Meyer. It's about teenage vampires and a relationship that vegetarian vampire Edward Cullen has with a 17-year-old mortal, Bella Swan. We're talking about summer reading for kids with librarian Sherry Eskin of the Honan Alston branch of the Boston Public Library. Sherry, first I have to ask, vegetarian vampire? What, does he bite tofu?
Nope. Vegetarian is sort of a misnomer. He goes out and hunts animals.
Okay.
He doesn't suck the blood of people, but he goes hunting here and there and eats animals in the forest.
The author of this series is a 34-year-old mother, a Mormon. She's being called the next J.K. Rowling. Newsweek had a recent article entitled Unhappily Ever After, saying adolescent fiction, you know, in part hers, has gone dark. We're talking about a vampire, you know, they're right, aren't they?
They are right. I think kids really are looking to embrace the dark. Their lives can be so difficult as it is, and it helps them deal with their problems and see their problems in another light.
Let's take a look at some of the middle school books. This one is The Black Book of Secrets by F.E. Higgins. It has this burnt black color to it. Even the edges of the pages are black. What are we being told by this book?
One of the nice things about the Black Book of Secrets, unlike a lot of books, it's a historical dark book. It's creepy, but it's also sort of Victorian. It's kind of this faux Victorian thing, which is kind of nice. Ludlow Fitch, the main character, he runs away from his parents after they try to sell the teeth out of his head.
While they're still in his head, we need to say.
While they're still in his head, he becomes apprenticed to a man who's a pawnbroker of secrets. And they write down the secrets as the townspeople tell them, and they write them down in their Black Book of Secrets.
And so this is a child from a family that doesn't seem to care about him.
Oh, no.
In this town, there's an evil guy who runs the place. They all owe him money. Gloom and doom. Who comes to the rescue?
The villagers all expect that Joe, who's the pawnbroker, they want him to come to the rescue. And Joe really insists that it's not his role. And instead, the townspeople have to figure out how they're going to do it by themselves, and they're going to break out of this control that he has over them.
Okay, we won't give away the ending, but that's The Black Book of Secrets by F.E. Higgins. We also have Gregor the Overlander, about a boy who finds a secret passageway in his house to a world beneath his world. Here's 11-year-old Noah Miller Metzen with a reading.
Gregor ran toward the light. It leaked through a narrow crevice between two smooth walls of rock. He tripped out from between the rock walls and landed on his hands and knees. When he raised his head, Gregor found himself looking into the face of the largest cockroach he'd ever seen.
Ew! Gregor has fallen into a world with giant bugs. What is the underlying purpose of this story?
Well, I mean, it's a hero quest story. Gregor falls into this world, and the Underlanders are convinced that Gregor's arrival fulfills a prophecy that he's going to be the one that's going to save their kingdom from the evil rats. And Gregor doesn't, he's sort of a reluctant hero, but then he discovers that his father, who's been missing from his family for 2 years, is being held by the rats.
Okay, that's Gregor the Overlander. The True Meaning of Smeck Day. Another book you're recommending for middle schoolers. What's this one about?
True Meaning of Smeck Day is a post-apocalyptic comedy. It's it's the end of the world. Aliens have taken over the planet, and all Americans have to move to Florida. And our heroine is Gratuity. She's 11. Her mother has been sucked away by an alien spaceship, and she refuses to move to Florida with everybody else. And so she goes on a quest in the family car to find her mom. And on the way, she meets a renegade alien, and the two of them become fast friends and end up saving the planet from an even bigger, more evil alien race. And it's hysterical.
Okay, that's The True Meaning of Smeck Day. But we're going to go back to older teen fiction. We started with the story of 17-year-old vampires in Twilight. And now let's go to 13 Reasons Why. It's by first-time author Jay Asher. It's on the New York Times bestseller list. In this novel, the main character, Clay Jensen, receives a shoebox filled with tapes, and they're from Hannah Baker, a classmate who's just committed suicide. This is 14-year-old Miho Ichikawa reading. She goes between two voices. One is Hannah speaking on the tape. The other is Clay reacting to what he's hearing.
Hello, boys and girls. Hannah Baker here, live and in stereo.
I don't believe it.
No return engagements, no encore, and this time absolutely no requests. No, I can't believe it. Hannah Baker killed herself. I hope you're ready, because I'm about to tell you the story of my life. More specifically, why my life ended. And if you're listening to these tapes, you're one of the reasons why.
This is some tough stuff.
It is. One thing you have to consider is that there's a real high incidence of teens committing suicide. And it's something that a lot of teens do think about if they're having problems in school and having problems with home. I mean, it's definitely a real thing for teenagers. And this book doesn't hold any punches. It doesn't have a happy ending, but it does have hope, which is really nice.
Well, again, the book 13 Reasons Why by Jay Asher. And now, if a parent's listening and they see that on their kid's desk, they may want to open a dialogue with them. You know, what interested you about this book? Why'd you take this one out of the library?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a great way of talking to your kids about it. I think it's really important stuff that, frankly, every teenager should be reading.
Well, another book that some parents might be, you know, want to know if their children are reading is Elsewhere by Gabrielle Zevin. It's about the afterlife. We have a reading from Daniel Miller Medson. This passage deals with the main character, Liz Hall, trying to find her way to the Office of Acclimation, which in Elsewhere is kind of a processing area for the recently deceased.
Liz opens the door. Inside, she finds a busy, perfectly ordinary-looking reception area. If not for a faded, rather macabre poster hanging on the wall, Liz may have thought that she was at her doctor's office. The poster depicts a smiling gray-haired woman sitting up in a mahogany coffin. Printed on the poster are the following words: "So you're dead. Now what? The Office of Acclimation is here to help."
The Office of Acclimation in the book Elsewhere by Gabrielle Zevin. Same question. You know, I mean, is this tough to read or charming or what?
This is actually quite charming. I mean, all teenagers are going through a realization of who they are, and this is just a different way of looking at it. When you get to Elsewhere, you age backwards from the time that you're there. So Liz is 15. Every year that she's there, she gets younger. And then you're reborn when you're 7 days old. You're reborn, you get sent back down the river, and you get reborn as a new person.
Okay, that's Elsewhere by Gabrielle Zevin. And finally, we have Wicked Lovely, a New York Times bestseller by Melissa Marr, about a girl who can see fairies.
Yeah, you know, it seems like a little kid book, but actually seeing fairies is a real burden. She sees them beating each other up. She sees them bothering mortals. And it's a real awful thing that she has to live with and that her family has had to live with.
You know, and here I am thinking, and now we come to the lovely, you know.
Oh, no. No, still very dark. For the first time, now the fairies are interested in her, and they think that she's going to be the next summer queen, which is a huge responsibility. One night, she goes off with the fairy king. She gets drunk on fairy wine, and she's worried afterwards whether she lost her virginity to the fairy king, because she isn't sure she wants to, because she still has a mortal boyfriend who's very special to her.
Boy, I mean, you know, we've had hints of this throughout time. You know, Snow White just goes to sleep for decades, and, you know, Cinderella, we're not quite sure what would happen with Cinderella if she didn't have to be home at midnight, you know. So nobody has really talked about these things explicitly. This is pretty explicit.
It's very direct. It's what happens when teen fiction meets fairies. That's what happens. You worry about your virginity at the same time as you worry about saving the world from the Winter Queen.
Sherry Eskin, children's librarian at the Hone and Alston branch of the Boston Public Library, her recommendations for great summer reads for students. Sherry, thank you so much for coming in and sharing them with us.
Thanks for having me.
Did you know that when the sun shines bright and everyone's singing along your way with the fairies? And if I tried to enter your own world, I might as well not try at all. Just push.